This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. Yes, there's supposed to be a break between elections, but alas, we're well on our way to the 2016 election, and the presidential race is heating up. It's probably easier to name those Republicans who aren't running rather than those who are. With potentially more than 20 candidates, the presidential race to reclaim the White House for the GOP seems like a free-for-all. On the Democratic side, all eyes and other candidates are waiting for the pronouncement from Hillary Clinton. Who are these candidates vying to be the next president of the United States, and why are they starting so early in the process? Joining us to help decipher these political tea leaves are Dr. Susan Roberts, who is an associate professor of political science at Davidson College. She teaches courses on the presidency, Congress, political parties, campaigns, and interest groups. Her research focus is on political capital and is currently working on a book about politics and women's reproductive rights and issues. She is frequently sought commentator by Charlotte Media about local and national politicians and political affairs. Good morning, Susan Roberts.
Good morning.
Tom Bullock from WFA News decided to trade the khaki-clad masses and traffic of Washington, D.C. to come to work in Charlotte for the same reason for WFAE in 2014. While in the nation's capital, Tom spent 15 years working for NPR, where he spent 5 years as a senior producer for NPR's foreign desk, where he produced and reported from Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Haiti, Egypt, Libya, Lebanon, among others. And probably just as dangerous an assignment, he served as a senior producer for NPR's election unit in 2008. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
And joining us by phone is Dr. Kenneth Fernandez, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and Policy Studies at Elon University and directs the Elon University Poll. His research interests include public opinion and public policy and teaches courses in American politics, research methods, urban politics, and ethnic and minority politics. Good morning, Dr. Fernandez.
Good morning.
If you want to join the conversation about what looks like the crowded presidential field for next year, send us an email to charlottetalks@wfae.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. If you would please indulge me for just about a minute, I hope I can get this off in a minute, because I'm going to read in alphabetical order the GOP candidates who are thinking about or are making all the right moves towards mounting a presidential campaign. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, U.S. Senator from Texas Ted Cruz, former HP CEO Carly Fiorina, U.S. Senator from South Carolina Lindsey Graham, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, Ohio Governor John Kasich, U.S. Senator from Kentucky Rand Paul, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, former Texas Governor Rick Perry, U.S. Senator from Florida Marco Rubio, former U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania Rick Santorum, and Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Many other names are being considered, but that's 15 right there. Let me ask you all, but let me start with Susan first. Have we ever seen a field this crowded, and what do the numbers tell us?
I think the numbers tell us that, there's no incumbent, but I think also they tell us that Republicans are feeling really good. They had the enthusiasm gap in 2014, and I think they look at this and say, there are parts of Hillary Clinton, the presumed nominee, that can be very vulnerable. They can go from her role as First Lady, Senator, Secretary of State, her speaking schedule, and I think they're seeing her as vulnerable, and they feel good about 2016.
Ken, what do you see?
I think that the more people you see thinking that they have a shot suggests that this might be a good year, 2016 might be a good year for Republicans. This is an expensive process. It's a painful process. I don't think people enter the race lightly. They know it's a toll on their health and their family. So I think it suggests that Republicans think they have a real shot.
So you think, even with the what you describe as the pain, you think all of these folks think that they have a legitimate a capability to earn the nomination for the GOP?
Well, that's a good question. A good friend of mine and colleague, Dave DeMore, he wrote a paper talking about sort of why people choose to run and why do they stay in the race when it seems quite obvious that they have no chance. So there are other elements, they can elevate their own status, they can affect the agenda, right? They can talk mm-hmm. about issues that are really important to themselves, even though they know that they're not going to win the presidency. So for some of these people, this could be a political, an agenda issue, but for some of these people, they think it's a they have a real shot, or 4 years later, to 2020, this helps them win in that race.
Okay. Tom?
Well, I think the one thing that's missing so far is this also shows that there is no unified GOP. I think what you find here are quite a few people who can, you know, legitimately say that they can court this side of that party or that side of the party. And that's really the modern state of the Republicans. There is not this monolith that it used to be. I mean, it used to be that you had a presumed frontrunner from the beginning. Mm-hmm. The primary process was simple, clean, and as little bloodletting was done as possible. Now it seems to be a lot more open season, almost more like a classic Democratic primary where you just see lots of fighting.
And on the Democratic side, we'll get to this, but they've got the presumptive front runner.
Yeah,
they've
flip.
Got the coronation basically underway already, and it's the Republicans trying to fight amongst different factions. You talked about basically the different factions. Mm-hmm. Who are the different factions within today's modern Republican Party that all these candidates are kind of vying for?
Well, there are almost as many factions as there are candidates running, I mean, quite honestly, but the core ones are simple. You have what is broadly called the establishment Republicans. They tend to be more moderate Republicans, at least on the current political spectrum today. They tend to be somebody like a Jeb Bush who can, you know, say that we're going to open the party up to a bigger tent. You know, mm-hmm. we're include these are the people who are going forward with things like immigration reform, tax reform. They say that they really can work across party lines. Then you have, you know, the classic kind of Tea Party set, which is, you know, no compromise, no argument. You have to follow a strict guideline when it comes to policy, or else, you know, we're going to throw you to the side. But even in the Tea Party set, there is, you know, kind of classic Tea Party people, which again focus on, say, tax issues. Mm-hmm. But then you have a social conservative wing. You have a social conservative wing of the Tea Party, which is a different subset because they have slightly different views. And then you know, like just again, like the Democrats, I don't want to make it sound like this is solely for the Republicans. You also have kind of an angry minority at the far, far edge of their political spectrum who want the Republican Party to be as they imagine it, which is a lot more basically, they see it as fighting the good fight. They see it as sticking to Republican principles so strictly that there is absolutely no room for maneuver on a lot of key issues like tax, like mm-hmm. social issues, gay marriage, reproductive rights, those kinds of things.
Susan, you see the same thing, the ideological versus pragmatic kind of
sure, and
willing
I think,
to compromise?
You know, years ago, there was really what the GOP called a purity test. Mm-hmm. That's no longer there. And they're really not, there's not a purity test, nor is there a policy test. And I think you see several people, and Tom is right, the Tea Party has wanted to set the agenda, but now they can really set who's in, who's viable, and who's not viable. And I think you've got to look at the policies. How much do we want to put emphasis on immigration? What policies will play where? And I guess you also look at, they're going to have to look to see what plays in the South. And I think that's still open. Is it the biblical South, the conservative mm-hmm, South? Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to be each of these candidates with the niche that the Republicans hope? I believe that that Growth and Opportunity Project that the Republicans put out several years ago just hasn't been really fully realized, and they don't know exactly who they are. I think they're more comfortable with how they're going to go about getting the election, but they don't really know that purity or that policy.
Ken, do we see this evident in surveys? I mean, you run the Elon poll. Do we see this kind of multifaceted factionalism play out in public opinion when you talk to Republican voters, particularly primary voters?
You know, I think it's a good question. I think with open primaries, I think that helps the establishment Republican.
Okay, describe what an open primary is.
Well, when you can choose sort of which party that which primary you want to, regardless okay. of sort of where you register, and so different states have different regulations on sort of who's allowed to vote in that particular primary. And so I think when you can have independents choosing between whether I'm going to vote for in the Republican primary or the Democratic primary, you're going to see a lot of independents choosing the Republican because, as we mentioned just recently, there's a lot more choices going on. And I think that may help an establishment Republican. And so you're going to see a Mitt Romney or a Jeb Bush or win this. But again, I think what your guests have said, absolutely, there are libertarian elements, there are business, immigration issues, abortion issues that are really sort of driving different constituencies. But when we look at our Elon poll that we just released, you know, it seems to be Jeb Bush, who's an established name, is on the minds of many Republicans. Now, part of that is just name recognition, but that's an important element of sort of being a viable candidate.
Okay. Larry Sabato, who runs a research center at UVA, has divided basically the GOP field into different groups, front runners, credible contenders, outsiders, and the, quote, gadflies and golden oldies. How not to get too specific, but maybe we need to focus on kind of maybe the top two groups. Susan, who do you see as kind of the top of the field and then maybe the potential contenders out of this group?
Sure. I think Jeb Bush and Scott Walker are still at the top of the tier. What's been interesting the last few weeks, the last month, is all the ink that's been spilled about how Chris Christie has even dropped, perhaps for some people, out of the top of the second tier to the top of the third tier.
Why?
I think because of some of the speeches, his baggage. The Rutgers poll actually put him at a distinct disadvantage in New Jersey because of things like pensions, Bridgegate, and some other issues. And I think that's what's been guiding that that story. But I think I would have to say Jeb Bush and then Walker, although Walker is just, you know, people are fascinated with him now.
Is he the flavor of the month?
He is the flavor of the month, and I think he's got the buzz, he's got the momentum. He's doing well under scrutiny, and as we talked about earlier before the show, he's been doing very well in terms of throwing the red meat, mm-hmm. which the Republicans like to see.
Okay. Ken, who would you add, along with Jeb Bush and Scott Walker, who else would you throw into the mix to kind of be out of this group of 15, 20 that folks should start to probably pay attention to?
You know, it's a good question because, you know, we asked that question of sort of who would you like to see run in 2016, and from October to February, we see some remarkable changes. Mitt Romney in October was the number one name. Of course, now he's barely mentioned, and it's not a surprise because voters know that he's not running. He chose not to run. So voters are responding to new information. Scott Walker was not mentioned by a single individual in our October poll. Now 12%, 13% of Republicans mention him. He's closely behind Jeb Bush. But a distant third is Ben Carson. He's sort of been there. I don't know if he's really a contender. But again, as you mentioned, the flavor of the month, these things can change remarkably. You know, Howard Dean, 2004, he was basically the heir apparent, and then that just evaporated. You know, Gary Hart, 1988. So, of course, there are certain circumstances that cause these events, but really, you know, polling at this early time does sort of tap into some viability, mm-hmm. but the research suggests it's the polls right before the Iowa caucus that are actually a pretty darn good predictor. But right now, it may be a little bit too early to tell. What we find is Ben Carson and Mike Huckabee are sort of third and fourth, but you know they're really only getting 6% mention, 4% mention.
We'll pick up with that thought after the break. That's Ken Fernandez from Elon University, along with Susan Roberts from Davidson and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. We're talking presidential primary politics on Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance journalism excellence in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org. The fight over a proposed toll project on I-77 is now in court. An anti-toll group is suing North Carolina over its solution to horrible traffic in the Lake Norman area. We'll cover the latest on that project and then transition to a big change under Obamacare that hasn't received as many headlines, how hospitals are now getting Medicare bonuses or penalties based on readmissions, infections, and quality metrics. We'll talk about all of that tomorrow on Charlotte Talks at 9 here on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the number of children allergic to peanuts has skyrocketed. A new study suggests doctors have been giving the wrong advice about peanuts for years. What research now says about preventing the sometimes life-threatening allergy.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-supported 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. We're talking about the invisible primary season that we're currently in with a crowded field of presidential contenders with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Dr. Kenneth Fernandez from Elon University, and Dr. Susan Roberts of Davidson College. We want to know what you think about the 2016 presidential race so far. Who do you think is the most impressive candidate in the GOP field of presidential candidates? And should another Democrat run against Hillary Clinton? If so, who? Find us on Facebook or send us a tweet or send us an email, charlottetalks@wfae.org. Kat on Twitter says Elizabeth Warren should run against Hillary. And Melanie on Twitter says Jim Webb should run against Hillary. We've been talking about the Republican field, but the almost kind of coronation feel that the Democrats are going through. Could somebody really mount a challenge to Hillary Clinton, and who would that be? Susan?
Well, I think earlier when we went through that list and Ken was talking about why would these people ever want to run, you have to have ambition to run. And even though people say that Hillary doesn't like the politicking that much, Elizabeth Warren probably would like it even less. She has a brand of being a firebrand, and she can push that progressive agenda. I think that if you look deeper down and you say Bernie Sanders is considering it, at that point, the Republicans don't even have to worry about electability, because I really think it's inevitable that a Republican would get that nomination.
Right.
I think, too, it's name recognition. But when you get back to it, we mentioned money, Bush can, Hillary can. Could Elizabeth Warren, could Joe Biden, could Bernie Sanders, could Webb, could some of the others? And I would have to say no. And you have to have money to be credible, especially with the primary calendar and the general election.
Okay.
And that's where I think Warren would really suffer.
So we're basically looking at, on the Democratic side, not just the former First Lady, U.S. Senator, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, but former U.S. Senator from Virginia, Jim Webb, who's basically announced that he's, I think, starting his exploratory committee. We'll get into that in just a minute. Former governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, I believe, has expressed interest. As Susan said, the Democratic Socialist U.S. Senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders. Vice President Joe Biden. I mean, normally one would think, Tom, that a sitting vice president
at the end
of a second term presidency would be the natural front runner leader.
And in a normal year, that is exactly what would happen. But we're still starting to see a little bit of that. I mean, he was in town. Joe Biden was in town last week with Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox.
Did he sound like a presidential
candidate? Oh, absolutely. In fact, I was there at the event and I'm sitting there listening to it. And if you broke down the speech, Joe Biden's section of the speech, Anthony Fox did what he was supposed to do. He went out and pushed the president's policies on transportation, the need to invest in infrastructure, this $478 billion plan to kind of modernize, rail and air and roads. Joe Biden was just kind of being Joe Biden. I mean, he went through every conceivable checklist item that you do when you're testing out material, basically for a stump speech. He talked about how the middle class is taking a huge hit. He talked about a bright future that he sees for the country. He talked about, how he and the name placement was key. He's like, all these things that are happening, the better economy. This isn't because of Joe Biden. This isn't because of President Barack Obama and Joe Biden. That actual phrase was not just used here, but it was used in South Carolina. It was used in Iowa the week prior. It's probably being used in New Hampshire right now because that's his next stop. It's clear that he is testing the waters, but there are a lot of issues with the Joe Biden candidacy. I think a lot of people forget that he ran for president in 2008. Mm-hmm. He came in fifth with 1% in Iowa and had to end his campaign there. So you have to wonder, is he basically just setting himself up in case Hillary stumbles, or is he a legitimate contender?
Ken, what did you find in the Elon poll? Did you ask about Democratic candidates? You know, the dominance of Hillary is kind of presuming that she is it. But did anybody, you know, register any other folks?
Yeah, I mean, we basically saw that about 44%, 43% of Democrats just mentioned Hillary Clinton, and about 6% in second place is Elizabeth Warren. That's a steep drop. And then after that is Joe Biden with only 2.6% of people mentioning that they'd like to see him run. After that, it's Ben Carson. We actually see a lot of Republicans that Democrats are mentioning, which suggests that when it comes to name recognition of potential candidates on the Democratic side, we're really talking Clinton, Warren, and Biden, and that's it. Now, that doesn't mean that someone new information, these results will change, but it is remarkable that when we ask Democrats, they're mentioning Ben Carson, Mark Rubio, Jeb Bush, Mitt Romney, Ron Paul, Chris Christie, and way down at the bottom is, you know, Bernie Sanders, Cory Booker. So really, it does seem that the Democratic field is extremely small, and they're waiting for the first move to be made by Hillary Clinton. Once she sort of officially is in the ring, then I think some decisions will be made by some candidates, and then we can actually start to see some maybe some attacks on her or some attacks from Republicans on her to see some vulnerability that might bring in some Democrats into the field.
Do we have a sense of when she is thinking about making this formal announcement?
She probably has an incentive to delay as much as possible. Again, I think it minimizes the attacks on her. But again, at a certain point, she's going to have to make an official decision.
Right, Tom?
I would argue that we're going to start seeing, you know, the Jeb Bushes and the Hillary Clintons and all the major top-tier candidates start announcing this April. And the reason for that is pretty simple. April means that you'll finish the first quarter of 2015 in terms of fundraising. You report it, and they want those eye-popping numbers when it comes to how much money their campaigns are raising. Now, the numbers are going to be a little skewed because, of course, this is a post-Citizens United world. So you start seeing a lot of money being raised by super PACs and 501s and all these different organizations that don't have to report the same way a candidate does. But my expectation is April, probably around mid-April, we'll start really seeing all of these people officially making announcements.
Susan?
Well, and money is the best way to discourage other challengers. If you look at Jeb Bush, there was a lot written recently about big Park Avenue fundraisers where he can deliver $4 million in an evening, and his America Rising PAC that's doing so well. With Hillary Clinton, what might be a consideration in terms of the money is people are really giving scrutiny to the Clinton Foundation and $4 billion. And where did this money come from? About a third of it, they would argue, came from foreign donors. And I think, you know, she also has to, you know, consider there was a lot of backlash against when she said we were broke when we left the White House and these, you know, big ticket prices for her speeches. So the money consideration, I think she can wait, but I think when it comes down to it, money can discourage some of these others.
All right. Is that going to be, I mean, Republicans certainly are going to go after Hillary Clinton for all the things that you just mentioned. Would it be wise for her to have a credible challenger in the primary to raise those issues and get her ready for the political attack that you know is going to be coming from the Republican machine? I mean, is it incumbent upon her to – I mean, she hasn't run for political office since, what, 2008?
2008.
So, you know, just like Jeb Bush, maybe she's a little rusty. Maybe she needs to thicken up that skin. Is it incumbent upon Democrats to put somebody up to say, look, we're going to go with Hillary, and we've got David on Facebook says women can no longer be kept from being our top executive. No one in the world is more qualified than Hillary Clinton. She would be our best hope. Does she need the challenge?
Well, at the risk of sounding like my mother, who used to always say, I read somewhere that. I read somewhere that she has started some kind of opposition research against herself. What are they going to say about me? And that she's trying to even outvet what another challenger would do. And she's written, there have been pieces about how she's trying to really use a market strategy to brand herself. And I think that at this point, a challenger would not necessarily weaken her, but it would distract the Democrats and maybe the leaners that she wants to get.
If you don't mind me stepping in on this too, I have to say from a pure strategy and tactical standpoint, the Republicans are going to be coming after Hillary no matter what. The ads will start running as soon as she announces. She will see exactly what their attacks are going to be and respond specifically to those attacks. Having a Democrat do that, again, just from a tactical standpoint, is not necessarily going to help her because they'll already be out there. And what it may do, at least from a Democratic standpoint, is start to divide the party. Hillary Clinton, the reason that I think Elizabeth Warren it was such a threat to Hillary Clinton, you know, when it comes to the Democratic base, is she actually appeals to a side of the party that Hillary Clinton has sometimes had trouble appealing to. So if you start dividing the party, it could weaken Hillary Clinton, you know, once you get through the primary and into the general election.
Okay. Peggy emailed in, says that Scott Walker is an intriguing candidate. If John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, decides to run, I think he has a good shot. Ken, are we going to experience the same thing that we went through in 2012 with kind of the roller coaster? You know, this month it's Rand Paul. Next month it's Scott Walker. The next month it's whoever. Are we going to experience that same kind of thing happen from 4 years ago that could potentially happen this year?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, with this many candidates, and many of them are experienced candidates, high quality candidates with plenty of elected office experience. And we're going to see this even once the primaries start. You know, you're going to see one contender just doing well in one state like Georgia, and all of a sudden the media will pick up on that, and that will give them some momentum, but that momentum will then disappear. It's going to be a roller coaster, and that's one of the reasons why I think this fascinates such a large segment of the population. It is unpredictable. And so even the front runners that we sort of think or the heir apparent, they quickly can disappear, like the Howard Dean in 2004. So absolutely, it's going to be a roller coaster. And we find that information changes people's opinion. We did a head-to-head question, Clinton versus Jeb Bush. Clinton seems up by a number of points. But part of that is just simply probably a lot of people couldn't even tell you what state Jeb Bush was governor of. But that's going to change because more information is coming out. And that kind of competition could help the Republicans, where if Hillary Clinton is being ignored by the media, having no challenger and no competitive races on the Democratic primaries, in the end, you know, it saves her money, but it might not necessarily be to her benefit.
All right. Let me pick up on a theme that you just talked about, and I want to get everybody's reaction on this. Heir apparent. We're talking about dynasties. We're talking about Clintons. We're talking about Bushes. It seems like We've kind of fallen into this, we want what was passed, even though those past presidents, you know, one was impeached, one went to war and saw his popularity just plummet. I mean, we have the father, son, potentially another son in this. What is it about this kind of dynasty talk that seems to be so dominant this year, Susan?
Well, I think one of the reasons is that they're known quantities. People really want to be able to explain why they're voting for someone. And that invisible primary, name, recognition, money, and organization, you have all three of those with the Bush and the Clintons. And I think if you look in that, and you also throw in Jeb Bush's and the Florida primary or the Florida vote, it's not a script that anyone would accept for a Hollywood movie. It is just so bizarre. And the bio factor is really the spouse family. And I think it's one that people are still trying to sort out. But I think the fatigue factor for Jeb Bush and the Bushes is probably greater than Clinton.
Why?
Well, I think Bill Clinton has made this fascinating phoenix rise from the things that you mentioned, being impeached. He's beloved when he walks into a room. He has far more success raising money and giving good luck to Democrats than Hillary. And I think, too, that Hillary is someone that will employ sources outside Daddy's Rolodex. And now people are looking at Jeb Bush and some of the things that he's really gathering some of his father's foreign policy advisors in a very kind of loose coalition. And in today's world, I'm not sure that makes a lot of sense.
All right. Let me pick up on that connection between Hillary and Bill. Jerry emailed, how much pushback is there among Democrats against Hillary Clinton as a candidate? Tom, is there any kind of sense? I mean, that seemed to be with Elizabeth Warren, that kind of, you know, stoking her fire to run really seemed to be the kind of anti-Hillary, but is that still prevalent?
No, I really don't think it is. I mean, what's interesting is how far the Democrats have really fallen in line behind Hillary Clinton. And I think it's quite surprising. I mean, in 2008 when she was running, and let's not forget, you know, she was the heir apparent then. I remember when I took over the election unit in October of 2007, everybody said, it's going to be Hillary Clinton and Rudy Giuliani. Well, obviously, that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
And what you saw with Hillary as she went along is she lost the Iowa caucuses. She came across as too polished, too much, almost a political robot, too much of a politician and not enough of a person. And then she cried and really had this kind of heartfelt moment, and she suddenly takes New Hampshire. You know, I don't think there's a lot of opposition when it comes to Hillary. I think someone like an Elizabeth Warren has a little bit more of a farther to the left pull than Hillary does, because she actually is a pretty centrist candidate, at least among the Democrats. But no, I mean, if there was more of an organization, if there was more of a backlash against this idea of dynasty, then I think you would see a legitimate third candidate popping up, as opposed to, you know, as Ken just said, the second place Democrat when it comes right now to the political race is a woman who says she is not running. So think about that. You know, you have 40-some percent for Hillary. You have 6% for Elizabeth Warren, who has come out publicly and said she's not running. And then you have 2% for Joe Biden, who's tossing around a balloon. The Democrats seem to be uniting.
Ken, do you see that as well?
Well, you know, I think Susan brought up an interesting point about fatigue, this Bush versus Clinton fatigue, and how much is there. And that's balanced out by sort of nostalgia, right? Because I think Democrats remember the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton's administration, as the good old days. The economy was just booming and unemployment was at historic lows. And I think Republicans, sort of very unhappy with the Obama administration, sort of look back at George W. Bush and the Bush family and feel, you know, very warm and fuzzy about that. And so I think there's these two dynamics that are playing against each other, and I'm not sure which one is going to be the biggest influence. We actually asked a question to Elon Poll. Do you think there's more corruption today compared to 100 years ago? And like 70% said, oh, there's more corruption today than 100 years ago. We generally have this very nostalgic feeling about the past, and Clinton and Bush sort of capture that, and that gives them, I think, an advantage over other competitors.
Tom?
I just want to bring up one thing, too. Let's not forget that, well, I would agree with all of the fatigue if it went Bush, Clinton, Bush, Clinton, but we've had another president, another 8 years in there to kind of break this sense of dynasty. So now is the time that we start seeing Bush and Clinton coming back. We've almost had a palate cleanser, as it were. It's not just the straight lineage going back and forth and back and forth. So I think that also kind of reset the public's opinion over electability.
Susan?
Well, and I think also the question about outsider or insider, many people are not sure if that's really more relevant than somebody that there is a known quantity, a brand name.
That's Susan Roberts from Davidson College, joined by Tom Bullock from WFAE News and Ken Fernandez from Elon University. We're talking presidential primary politics. I'm Michael Bitzer. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting iconic vocal group Manhattan Transfer, celebrating their 40th anniversary at Knight Theater on Friday. For tickets, visit BlumenthalArts.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock next on the Diane Rehm Show, new research on preventing peanut allergies. The number of children allergic to peanuts has skyrocketed. A new study suggests doctors have been giving the wrong advice about peanuts for years. A discussion of what the latest research says about preventing the sometimes life-threatening allergy. That's on the Diane Rehm Show coming up in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock here on 90.7 WFAE. If you'd like to join our discussion today on Charlotte Talks, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook and Twitter. We're coming right back.
From the moment you wake up through the chaos of your busy morning, Morning Edition is there with you.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Protesters have been
through
marching.
All you have to do, we'll bring you all you need to know tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Catch Morning Edition weekdays from 5 until 9 here on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
And welcome back to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking about 2016 and the prospective presidential contenders with Dr. Kenneth Fernandez of Elon University, Dr. Susan Roberts of Davidson College, and Tom Bullock of WFAE News. Susan, you've mentioned this notion of an invisible primary. We're going to have a visible primary, certainly starting with the Iowa caucuses, most likely in February, but potentially in January. What are the candidates doing now that makes it kind of the invisible primary leading up to the primary season?
Well, as Tom was mentioning, I think one of Hillary Clinton's problems, this air of inevitability, is she didn't have any long-term strategy. She thought by New Hampshire, it was golden for her. And I think the candidates now are going to have to look at how can we get, given the slew of Republican candidates, mm-hmm. how can I get some organization on the cheap in a lot of states? And I think that the primary calendar, the official primary calendar, will winnow pretty dramatically. And
how?
I think, well, you look at these and it's, as we mentioned before, there's news all the time, 24/7. And I think that if we look at the polling and the horse race, that inevitably comes with this. Polls are everywhere. They're all the time. If you go to Real Clear Politics, you can look at the variation in the polls. And it's sometimes very astounding. I think the primary calendar will help different candidates that don't have the money to compete in the long term make the decision that it's not mine anymore.
Okay, I want to get into the actual contest,
sure.
The real contest that will finally decide this. Ken, I want to pick up though on that notion. Do we see the polls kind of all over the place in terms of national? Should we be looking at specific states? What should just the casual observer be looking at and trying to understand this process when it comes to polling? Because it seems like literally there's going to be a poll every day talking about these races. What should the average observer look for?
Well, I think the average observer and the candidates are looking at polls because it does sort of express some viability. And I think that's why I think Romney sort of experimented with the notion of running, because the polls seem to see him as the front runner. Obviously that changed. Some things behind the scenes in this invisible primary sort of let him know that that was just not going to be probably a good strategy. Less than 24 hours, CPAC is going to happen. And
what is CPAC?
The conservative organization that happens every year, and you're going to see Donald Trump. You're going to see lots of individuals giving speeches. The media's going to cover that. That's going to change public opinion polls. That's going to put names in people's minds and change opinions. So these weekly events, you're going to have, as Susan mentioned, Chris Christie stumbles. These events are going to change because voters do read the newspaper. They respond to new information. And so these polls do need to be taken with a grain of salt because they are going to change. But again, there was one paper written that the polls right before Iowa caucus were an actual very good indicator of who's going to actually win the nomination. So these polls do matter, but they are going to respond to new information.
Tom, how are these candidates going to respond to to polls, you think?
Well, I think there's, as you said, we're in the invisible primary phase right now. And the invisible primary is kind of fun to watch because this is the one part of the presidential election cycle that has absolutely nothing to do with votes. It has absolutely nothing to do with it.
But what does it have to do with?
It has to do with two things. It has to do with money and people.
Okay.
And what Kim was just talking about is absolutely right. These polls show viability. Viability comes into two kind of branches. The first branch is money. You know, if polls continually show that someone like a Scott Walker is rising, then it helps you build up that war chest to go through what will be, likely be a bloody Republican primary with so many contenders. But there's another side to this too. And this is, you know, we keep talking about how Chris Christie is dropping down in these polls, but there is one side of the invisible primary where he's actually doing rather well. And that's by rallying together there's only so many political activists. There's only so many political advisors that are at a presidential level in a place on the ground like in Iowa or New Hampshire. And those people really can sway quite a lot in those small states. The invisible primary is about convincing those people to join you because everybody wants to join a winner. And, you know, you either sell them on your ideology or you sell them that you can win. And then with that comes this, you know, classic idea of momentum. If you do well in Iowa, then you can do well in New Hampshire, then more money flows in. And you do well with money and operatives. So those are the two things. So, you know, the Republicans, they're absolutely looking at the polls. So are the Democrats just to see what's going on. But it's only so they can sell. It's basically marketing at this point.
Okay. Susan.
Well, I think also, too, as Tom mentioned, you're looking at Iowa and New Hampshire, and there's a saying about Iowa, I don't vote for a candidate unless I've met him twice or her twice. And that could play into Christie's kind of populist appeal, Walker's populist appeal. I just don't know at this point how much of a populist appeal Jeb Bush has.
Okay. So Iowa is first with its caucuses. New Hampshire will be next with its primary. I believe Nevada is in there with the caucuses. And then South Carolina, just to our south. What – I mean, I guess one of the candidates in the Republican field, Lindsey Graham, is certainly – he has been to Iowa. I think he's going to New Hampshire. He's certainly a South Carolinian. What are his potential chances?
I think they're very slim. And I'll just mention this and let everybody else weigh in. He had Tea Party challengers this last time around, and that's very significant. And he also had –
He beat them pretty handedly.
But he's been part of, whenever a Republican or Democrat work together, they call it a gang. And he's been a part of a couple of gangs on the Hill in which a Republican has actually worked with a subsection of the Democrats. And that won't play well in South Carolina.
Okay. All right. North Carolina has kind of thrown a wrinkle into this primary process. In yesterday's Charlotte Observer, the North Carolina Republican Party chair wrote that the state should be relevant to the process and move its primary back. Where is it now and where does he want it to go, Tom?
Well, right now it comes the Tuesday after the South Carolina primary, which is a Saturday, I believe.
Okay.
So right now it looks like it's going to be coming sometime in February of next year. So
what's wrong with that?
Well, nothing in particular unless you want to follow the rules that are set out by the national GOP, which basically says that only four states, only Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada can have their either caucus or primary before March 1st.
Okay.
That March 1st line is pretty important because then you start looking at the so-called Super Tuesdays. And rather than just one Super Tuesday, because one apparently is not enough, we're looking at potentially two or three even Super Tuesdays. So what will happen with North Carolina if they stick to where it is now? Well, the official GOP line is you lose all but 12 delegates, and then we are not going to let you sit in a prominent place at the convention, and we're going to give you kind of a bad hotel, which basically means it's not within walking distance of the convention site.
Okay.
I know for most people this does not sound like a big deal. For parties, it actually is. But North Carolina it may be a dark red state when it comes to state politics. Nationally, it's very, very purple. And, you know, in the editorial you brought up, he basically said, look, this could be a problem for us. I'm not sure that I buy that because there's no North Carolinian on the ticket for, you know, the GOP for president in 2016. So losing the delegates may or may not be that big of a deal. And he also goes on to say, well, you know, maybe they won't come and pitch to North Carolinians, I don't think they have a choice. I think they have to. I think they have to show that they can win a battleground state like North Carolina to truly show that they are viable.
Ken, is North Carolina so important that they can basically break the national rules and go after South Carolina and have this kind of prominence in terms of picking the next, particularly on the Republican side, the next nominee for the party?
Yeah, I agree with Tom. I think North Carolina is different than Michigan. When Michigan broke the rules, you had some of the candidates sort of saying, well, maybe I'm not going to go and visit up there. They're going to have to visit North Carolina. It's just something down the line that they need to establish a great ground game so that they can win not only just the primaries, but in the general election. So, no, absolutely, I think Tom is right. North Carolina is just too important to ignore, and so they don't want to alienate voters, and so I think losing those delegates wouldn't be that big of a deal. I think we still get a lot of national attention, both during the primaries and during the general election.
Okay, two comments that we've gotten so far. Keith on Facebook says the unaffiliated voter will decide the outcomes. And Chip in Mooresville says, will the media end the horse race money reporting and hold candidates' feet to the fire on substantive issues and articulated plans? As a member and representative of the media, Mr. Bullock, are you going to hold these candidates' feet to the fire?
We always
literally or figuratively?
Well, I would go with the figuratively
okay.
because otherwise that would be a bad thing.
Okay.
No, absolutely. I think, you know, in fairness, it's a good point to bring up. You know, it's so easy for us to start talking about money, but reporting on money in politics now is more complicated than it ever has been because so much of it happens behind the scenes. And money in politics is a key part of the story. When it comes to actually holding their feet to the fire on policy issues, we try. But the point is you have to make sure that you can get politicians who aren't just going to give you a stump. And if they just keep going stump after stump after stump, then you tend just to hear the same thing over and over again. What I hope to see is a vigorous primary season debate or some kind of series of debates, because that potentially has the ability to really start digging into policy points.
Susan, how much money are we going to be looking at in this primary season? Let's not even talk about the general election. Let's just
I can
get
say
through
with
the
all
nominee.
Certainty we will break the record from the year before. That is, I will take that to the bank. But I think I think it's also a question of the money follows the momentum.
Okay.
And one of the questions about the primary that we didn't bring up, and I think your caller's right about the independent vote, perhaps in the general election. But the profile of the primary voter is very different from the voter in the general election. And these are going to be primary voters that are going to be looking at who best represents my party. Is this person electable? And they're going to be looking in the short term in the first primaries, but also in the long term to say who will beat Hillary Clinton.
Ken, do you agree with that? Who are these primary voters, these caucus attenders? Who do we know anything about these folks?
Yeah, I mean, I think before the open primary, the primary voter was extremely different from the general voter. And so you did find that party elites were picking people that were more left or right of the political spectrum. With open primary, that may be a little bit different. You're going to get a little bit more maybe of an established Republican. But again, you know, going back to Hillary not having a competitive primary, I think these primaries are a good way of establishing a ground game, getting people registered to vote. And if you obviously voted in the primary, you're going to vote in the general election. In 2012, turnout during the primaries were historical lows. That seemed to maybe help Obama. I'm not sure who that's going to help in 2016. It actually could help the Republicans. So I think there's some interesting issues and dynamics. Hillary Clinton being the heir apparent for the Democrats might not necessarily be that good for the Democratic Party.
What if, and I use this in the intro, and I'm going to throw it out there, what if Hillary decides not to run?
I think the Democrats scramble. I mean,
does it become a free-for-all like on the Republican side?
Absolutely. I really at this point think it is, because there's not enough of a ground game that's being set up by anyone else at this point. So you're going to see a scramble. You're going to see everyone grabbing the bits and bobs of a campaign organization and trying to put it together into a machine as quickly as possible. And, you kind of have that with Joe Biden. You could have that with an Elizabeth Warren. But, you know, we've talked about, you know, Webb from Virginia and some of the other names that are out there. They just don't have that cachet. And I honestly wonder, too, if Hillary, for some reason, drops out or doesn't run or whatever the case is, do people start wondering, is it because there's something wrong with the Democratic Party writ large? Because she has been working at this for years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just brings up more questions than answers, in my opinion.
Well, so, I also think that you also have to look at who exits early. Right now, if you were looking at the Democratic bench, if you were to say who is going to be Hillary's running mate, I don't know that I could really tell you. I don't think it'll be Elizabeth Warren, and it's not being critical against Hillary Clinton, but I think Hillary Clinton wants to be president, and she wants to be the first woman president. And I don't think the first woman president wants to take along the first woman vice president. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you had to look at that, I'm not sure I could tell you who the vice president will be that will run with on the ticket with Hillary Clinton. I think it would be a very real problem, and the turnout would be very low in a general election in which the Democrats are going to have to face a lot of obstacles from these new voter ID laws. Mm-hmm. That's already a problem.
And it's an interesting point, too, with the vice presidents, because you look at, again, at this incredibly crowded field of potential GOP candidates. Some of them are there not to be president, but to be considered for vice president. That's just the way the system works. And yeah, you can see that. But you're right. Well, you know, Susan, it's a great point with the Democrats. If there's no clear number two, if there's no clear, you know, second place or mm-hmm. even third place finisher, you really have to scratch your head and wonder who the vice president will be.
Ken, is this an audition process that we're basically coming down to?
I don't know if Sarah Palin was actually auditioning. That seemed to surprise a lot of individuals that she was a pick. And I think Hillary Clinton would, I think Susan's right, pick not a woman, but a male, and probably a bit of a younger male, and maybe just a fresh face to sort of counterbalance her sort of name recognition and sort of counterbalance that potential fatigue of the Clinton name. So, yeah, it probably isn't anyone that we've mentioned now, and it could be someone that sort of is sort of a new face to many voters.
We talked about the role of money in all of this. What about independent groups? Are we going to see the rise? I mean, we certainly saw the rise in the 2014 midterm election of the power of independent groups pumping in money, uncoordinated, quote unquote, from candidates. Could we potentially see that?
Well, I think we couldn't. Look at the Koch brothers. They've already announced how much money they're going to spend. That's incredible.
Okay. All right. We have been talking about presidential party politics. We've got a year till the first caucus starts, but we will be talking about this more over time. Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson College, Tom Bullock from WFAE News, and Dr. Kenneth Fernandez from Elon University. Thank you all very much for the hour.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer. Thanks for joining us.